Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of All the Hard Things. I have a very special guest here. When Naomi reached out to me with some things that she wanted to talk about, I was like, yes, this needs to be talked about more. You guys know that I am a big proponent of how all of this treatment stuff, it's not just necessarily about OCD, that everybody can really benefit from it. And so I am really excited to have Naomi Matlow here. She is a musical theater lyricist, a writer and educator, and she has such an amazing bio, you guys, like literally gives me chills to think about. But we're going to get into some really interesting topics here today. We're going to talk about Buddhism's Four Noble Truths and how that has to do with OCD and anxiety. We're going to talk about the senses and Buddhist psychology. And I cannot wait for this episode. We've never done anything like it. And so stoked to share it with you today. So Naomi, thank you so much for being here. If you could please give us a little bit of a background and let us know some of the cool stuff that you've done, like your master's in mindfulness studies. Oh my gosh, how cool. Let us know kind of your background and what got you interested in this work.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much, Jen. I've been a huge fan and proponent and advocate of your work. So this is such a thrill for me. Yes, so my name is Naomi Matlow. I am originally from Toronto, Canada, and now find myself in Ventura, California, which is in Southern California. And I am a writer and a mindfulness practitioner and an OCD. I don't want to say sufferer because I don't suffer with it all the time, but I have a very OCD inclined mind. I was diagnosed when I was 15 and now I'm 34 with very debilitating compulsive behavior based on fearful thoughts that primarily surrounded hurting people. What if I wanted to hurt people? What if I wanted to poison my sister? Really disturbing thoughts like that. And through CBT and ERP and ultimately ACT with an incredible guide and now mentor and CBT therapist in Toronto, who I would say saved my life truly. I have done the hard things, as you say, Jenna, to get to where I am today with a master's degree in mindfulness studies and in writing for musical theater living with my fiance now, getting married in a few short months. So I'm very honored to share this overlap that I've witnessed between Buddhist psychology and obsessive thinking that I felt very strongly about writing my thesis about for my master's that I graduated in September. And now kind of finding myself in a place of wanting to share this work more and hopefully write some sort of larger book or manuscript and courses perhaps in the future. But I feel like I'm getting ahead of myself. But that's a little bit about me and where I come from to the world of mindfulness and OCD education and therapy.
I love everything. If you could see me right now, you'd see I have like a ton of sticky notes with a ton of notes here. Well, I just love it so much. I mean, if you look on my website, if you look at everything that I do, probably one of the like most commonly used keywords that I used is ERP or exposure and response prevention. But I have come to the realization that I might lean very heavy into ERP, but I'm also so much more integrated in my approach with people. Like, I do talk a lot about mindfulness. I do talk a lot about like the spiritual nature of just like being, right? Like being and being that observer. I talk a lot about lots of different things. It's not just like if somebody were to work with me that we only talk about exposures and response prevention. So I love that you're bringing kind of your own integrated conceptualization of everything, because I think that's really important. when it comes to OCD and anxiety recovery, it's not just doing hard things like the exposures, and it's not just resisting your rituals. It's so much more than that. And that is why it can be like a lifestyle, right? I always tell people that this is not about just overcoming this subtype or that subtype. For you, it wasn't just overcoming this fear about this thing. Mm-hmm. It's like a whole person transformation that can give you this life of freedom. Yeah. So I would love it if you could talk to us a little bit about Buddhism's Four Noble Truths. So I'm going to be honest, like, I don't know the specifics when it comes to this stuff. So when it comes to more generalized concepts, I might be able to take a swing at it. But talk to us about Buddhism's Four Noble Truths and how that connects to the anxiety cycle that we know has everything to do with OCD and anxiety.
Absolutely. And with all honesty, this was very new to me. I entered the mindfulness studies program at Lesley University because I was interested in meditation and wanted to kind of understand where this all came from in an authentic way. And it does come from the Buddha. It was a real man 2,500 years ago. So what he discovered is that there are four noble truths that guide our lives and guide experience and are true for everyone, every being when they're born. Every human being is what we know for the most part. So truth one, that there is suffering. There is pain and suffering. If you're born into a human body, you will inevitably experience pain and suffering. And the second noble truth is that there is a way, the second noble truth is that suffering is caused by craving and clinging. From my understanding, that is when we don't let good things happen and want them to last forever, we're clinging to it. When bad things happen and we want them to immediately go away, we're clinging to it and we're craving for something else to happen. So the second truth is we will suffer more if we don't allow life to be as it is. Wanting things to be differently is the main cause of pain and suffering. And third, that there is a way out of suffering. And the fourth noble truth is this is the path, and it is the Noble Eightfold Path, which is only one spoke of the wheel, or the wheel of Dharma, as they say, the wheel of wisdom and the Buddhist teachings, is mindfulness. And they all start with the word right or wise. So there's wise mindfulness, wise intention, wise action. So it's really a path laid out by the Buddha where he found this is how to reduce suffering in a human lifetime. And when I learned about that from my teachers, I was like, oh my gosh, clinging and craving and wanting things to be different than they are is this internal OCD cycle. When I get, for example, when I get an anxious thought, like I don't like dogs. Like, dogs have been a topic of mine because we're dog sitting my fiance's parents' dogs. So I think, oh, maybe I don't like dogs. And then I'm clinging to that thought as if it's so important, and then mentally proliferate, oh, what does that mean about me? Am I a bad person? What if we get a dog and my future husband is resentful that I don't like dogs as much as him? And then I'm just clinging to that thought and craving that it leaves and goes away. And then I'm just in a cycle of suffering, as opposed to, oh, what if that thought is no different than a breeze that I feel on my cheek, or this light I see from this candle flickering in front of me? What if it's just a phenomena of experience, like any of the other five senses? This is the sixth sense of intellect that doesn't have any more value or substance just because it comes to me in words rather than a sight or a sound. So, yes, I guess that seems like a lot of talking. So maybe I'll stop there and see if that is making sense, or if I can build off of that.
Well, I love everything that you said, but I specifically what's just like hanging on the tail end of that for me is to consider intellect as the sixth sense. Like,
yes.
Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking of even the other senses, right? Like seeing, smelling, touching, tasting, hearing. Like there are times where those don't operate according to plan, right? There are times where I will be in the shower, especially after I had my son 6 years ago, and I would swear to you that I heard crying. Mm. I would swear to you that I heard crying. They're called phantom cries, right? Mm. And I would get out and I would rush out, like freaking out in my towel, soaking wet, and he was perfectly fine. There are times where I swear I hear my phone ringing or hear it, you know, feel it vibrating in my pocket. Or there are just things in our bodies a lot of times that don't make sense. I ran 7 miles the other day and I woke up and I felt fine. But there are days where, like, I can't even walk up the stairs without my legs creaking and making weird, funny pains, right? Like, there are lots of things in our sensory experiences that just don't make sense. Like, it yes. doesn't mean that we have to, nor should we. And a lot of us don't. We don't put those little experiences under a microscope and analyze them for the most part. We just chalk it up to, well, I'm a human being and my body is, you know, nothing that we can understand 100% of the time, right? And absolutely. If we were to consider our intellect as being the sixth door of experience there, we should view it as the same, that for the most part, our intellect is going to be fine, right? Like it helps us be able to get through podcasts like this and have these great ideas and communicate with other people and plan for the future and learn from the past. But every once in a while, because of our intellect and because of its complicated nature, there are going to be these spam experiences, just like the phantom cries, that don't make sense. The phantom cry isn't the problem. It's us, like you said, the clinging to that experience. Oh my gosh, why did that happen? What does that mean about me? And then, like you also said, craving something different, wanting it to go away, wanting freedom, wanting it to go away, wanting reassurance, and all that stuff. How do you handle, or what would you say to people who are like, well, oh my gosh, no, I can't handle that. Like, I can't sit with that. I can't possibly be okay with the fact that I could hurt my son. I can't possibly be okay with the fact that I could have cancer. Like, try to imagine all the people out there who are like, yeah, sounds good. But no, like, how am I supposed to accept that? What would you say to those people?
Yeah, that's a great question. And something that I struggle with in my own life. Like sometimes a thought is so disturbing and upsetting. And then I'll go into a spiral of, oh, did I really mean that? Did I want to do that? And that ultimately that there is mystery and so much that we do not understand. Like the phantom cry in the shower, or I feel like once a day I think my phone is vibrating in my pocket and then I look and it's not. And I guess I would say to kind of embrace the uncertainty to the best of one's ability. And I guess if it's very acute and causing a lot of emotional or physical disturbance, then perhaps at that point it is time to work with an ERP professional or do an ERP program. But if it's something that you feel, being able to kind of withstand and feel it in the body and recognize to the best of your ability that these are just words coming through the sense door of the mind. And I guess not in a way to completely distract, but release the clinging around that thought. And another thing I wanted to talk about that I learned, which is new to me, in Jeffrey Schwartz's book Brainlock, he coined the phrase, it's not me, it's my OCD. And I think that that's also something that we can practice internally, being like, this thought isn't me any more than hearing a bird outside my window is me. Like I am the one who experiences it. If only we could generate our thoughts out of our own volition, OCD wouldn't be a problem. So I guess I would say to kind of feel into that experience in a quiet place, in the cozy environment, and kind of lean into what if this thought isn't me? It's easier said than done.
Sure. And so much of it is, right? Mm-hmm. Anytime someone says, oh, easier said than done, I'm like, mm-hmm. Yeah, as are most things in life. Like, that doesn't mean it doesn't work and that it doesn't apply, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is so, so cool. Like, I just am totally geeking out. I have chills. I have goosebumps. Yeah. So just an example. I really love practical examples. So people mm-hmm. see themselves in this. This is so cool to, like, actually take all these concepts and then be able to apply it to real life kind of examples for people. Mm-hmm. So I recently was reached out to by someone who was really struggling, and everyone already always kind of believes that their OCD is different or special somehow, which I'm sure you mm-hmm. can, you know, relate to and probably totally. Have had your own experiences with it. You know, I get people who are just as headstrong with me about, well, my OCD is different because it could never happen. I would never be able to prove it wrong. Mm-hmm. And then I will have someone else on the opposite end of the spectrum say, well, my stuff did happen. That's why it is different, because it did happen or because it could happen, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, we have to, one, go back to one of the principles that you had mentioned, which is this universal suffering, right? Mm-hmm. You are not alone in your suffering, and that is part of being human. Mm-hmm. I think so much of us as, like, a human society, I don't know where we went wrong. I don't know if this is how we've always been, but, like, especially with social media and maybe, like, our own upbringing, maybe we're the first generation to try to work on actually sitting with discomfort versus trying to distract. But we are just really uncomfortable being uncomfortable. Like, yeah. We want to get rid of it at any turn. We want to distract. I mean, even when I'm with my mom and then my son, so, like, three generations, when my son is upset, the way that my mom and I both interact with him is completely different. I'm like, I get that you're sad, honey. Like, it's okay to be sad. Like, it makes sense that you're sad. Like, let me know what I can do to help you. And my mom, on the other hand, as well-meaning as she is, she's over here trying to distract him or, like, bring out her phone to try to, like, cheer him up right away. And it's like, I don't know where we, like, forgot or either, like, never learned that part, like, being part of being human and certainly of having a values-driven life is that you are going to have uncomfortable emotions and that's part of life. And we need to make space for that, which kind of brings me back to, like, some acceptance and commitment therapy type of stuff. I just love how it all works together.
Totally agree.
Someone mentioned to me in an email the other day that, like I said, they were really struggling. They were really struggling with this concept of something being, like, objectively dirty. Like, mm-hmm. they had nieces or nephews running around and, like, you know, little kids are dirty, like diapers and stuff like that. And this person was really struggling with, I'm not struggling with the fact that things could be dirty. I'm struggling with the fact that it is dirty. Like, it is objectively dirty. I know that they have peed on that floor and I'm never going to be, you know, safe again. I'm going to be contaminated forever. I'm struggling because it is dirty. It is dirty. And, you know, my resources for her were just about, like, acceptance, right? Like, acceptance. It's such, like, a big loaded word. What does acceptance mean to you?
Wow, I love that question so much. I find it so relevant and useful. I think acceptance means kind of surrender. It reminded me of I just got a flashback of an ERP I did. I was probably, like, 16 or 17 with my therapist, and my mom had got me a set of paints, like, in one, I think it was, like, the white paint said, like, this is toxic, like, children will ingest it and will go to the hospital. And I was like, I can't use these. Like, I can't use any of the paints. I can't use the white ones. I can't use any of the colors. And then I remember it was literally the surrender point of my ERP journey. We had to take those paints, I'm pretty sure including the light one, and go to a picnic bench with me and my CBT therapist and drop a little piece of paint squish some of paint on this picnic bench where I knew people were eating lunch. Like, I could see them. And then it was like, do you want your life to be controlled by a 0.1% fear of being the reason that somebody throws up and goes to the hospital? Or are you willing to surrender to that 99.9% risk that you can be free in this lifetime to literally self-express and paint something? So all to say, I think acceptance means really surrender and trust too. That this is something I'm working with in my own life, like under all the fear and uncertainty and stress and anxiety, is there like a little glimmer of trust within myself that knows, like, I'm not trying to hurt people. Like, can I feel into that, recognize? And I do a lot of work with a somatic therapist, and she says things like, where do you feel the trust? And I feel it like in my tailbone. There's like a groundedness that if I really sit, I can lean into that acceptance that I may mess up, but that's not my intention. And it's even hard to say because that's something that is always going to be hanging around. To that person that is struggling with the like actual, like, I know this child did pee on this and it is dirty. Can you trust that for the most part, it's going to feel really gross and uncomfortable, but as you say and do in your ERP practice, like, anxiety doesn't last in the peak forever. And if you're willing to surrender to the ebbs and flows of the anxiety cycle, it will come down. And it will feel really gross to touch someone's pee. But ultimately the body doesn't and the mind can't live in that fight, flight, or freeze mode for forever. I guess that's what I would say. And also, like you were saying too, like, that there is kind of, this is like a lifestyle, like it's a spiritual reckoning of kind of surrendering to the what the universe is trying to teach you or flow through you. Like, maybe this is this person's life project to become more free, is to really challenge themselves to feel really yucky and gross, but ultimately live a life in accordance with their values in spite of that.
Oh my gosh, so good. Like, this is, like, to me, this is ERP, like, that we've talked about that I wouldn't incorporate in what it is that we do.
I think
ERP gets a bad rap sometimes, like, that it's, and I always tell people that I work with, I truly believe that exposure and response prevention, it exists on a spectrum. Like, on one end of the spectrum, it's very rigid and it's manualized and, like, it's very clinical and you just do exposures and you just do response prevention. I've worked in hospital settings where, yeah, it was very rigid. It was very by the book. And some people needed that. But then on the other end, to me, exposure and response prevention really boils down to three things. It boils down to getting outside of your comfort zone, reducing safety behaviors or unhelpful coping, and then reducing avoidance. And, like, all these other amazing, beautiful strategies and concepts that you're talking about fit in so, so well for a nice integrated approach. And I love it. And another, like, piece that I love to integrate, which, again, is very conceptually similar to the things that you have referenced, is dialectical behavioral therapy, which is not just by itself an evidence-based treatment for OCD or anxiety, but I do love some of its strategies. So one that I refer my clients to all the time is the concept of there's only four solutions to any problem, and you got to pick one, right? So the four solutions to any problem are: one, you solve the problem; two, you change your perception about the problem; three, you radically accept it; or four, you stay miserable. And really, those are your only four options with any given problem, right? So you can solve the problem. You can continue to clean your entire house every time you feel that it's dirty, but chances are that's probably not working for you. You try to change your perception of the problem, similar to what it is that you're talking about, right? Like, is there a way that you can view that contamination differently? Way that you can, you know, challenge yourself to consider, like, maybe potentially that experience won't last forever, you know, so on and so forth. Three, radical acceptance. And I love the concept of radical acceptance, because it's like, it doesn't mean that I have to love it. It doesn't mean that I have to be happy about it, but I do accept what is in this moment. A necessary skill. That's a necessary skill to be human, to have a life worth living. And then, of course, four, stay miserable, which sometimes we like stay miserable, and that's okay. There's really only four options. So I love it. I love everything.
I love that. I didn't know. I'm not as versed in DBT, but I'm very interested. So I love that. And that's so relevant.
So relevant. Talk to us. I really want to make sure that we talk about this concept of the self and the non-self.
Yeah.
Already talked about it a little bit. Like, it's not me. It's my OCD. Which is very similar to the ACT concept of diffusion.
Exactly.
So tell me about that.
Yes. Okay. So this is such a juicy topic in Buddhist psychology and literature, and it's complicated, and every teacher can explain it differently. But what I wanted to share today, which is a very helpful understanding for me, is the idea of the mind being like the sky, that it's just, or the self. The self being like the sky, like it's like the canvas of experience to filter through, and or the self as witness, or the self as just as awareness, that this is helpful in the OCD journey or dealing with intrusive thoughts, because like we were saying, the thoughts aren't the self, because is a sound that you hear, like, is that a self? Is the like the feeling of my shirt on my body, like that's not me. So it's a way of kind of reframing experience if the mind, or what often gets confused with being the self, is like a sky and thoughts and images and feelings and smells and tastes. It's all just like clouds kind of passing through, and the clinging and craving and enhanced suffering comes when we kind of try to pull down a cloud from the sky and bring it to our face and being like, what does this mean? Where did this come from? Why do I have it? I wish it was gone. Like that. And kind of releasing the grip and just being like, the self is the sky. Like, I'm just, it's just the container for all of these perceptions to kind of flow through. And when one is really in distress, that's incredibly difficult to lean into. But at those moments of kind of ease and relaxation, whether you're like in a big meadow or are sitting on the beach or something, I feel like there's a glimmer of, yes, I'm just a witness. I'm just the canvas of all of these experiences and perceptions. None of my experiences is inherently me, or I can kind of pin down. And that's a really beautiful concept in Buddhism, that everything is changing, so nothing lasts long enough to be like, this is the self, because everything's growing and changing and evolving, and that's scary in some ways, but it's also incredibly liberating, because there's then we don't have to be so judgmental as much. Like, that nothing is inherently good or bad. It's just changing and morphing and ebbing and flowing. And there's huge books and treatises and stuff about this, and I probably just scratched the surface even in my own understanding of the theme of non-self in the Buddhist psychology literature. But I hope that is that's helpful. And it's helpful for me to kind of try and explain it, because it's something very experiential I've found.
So many good nuggets here. I am so excited to give this podcast to people who are struggling, because it's a totally different way to look through things. And it's something that everybody, it just really reminds us that these are strategies, not just because you have OCD, everybody as part of being a human can benefit from being able to see thoughts as thoughts. And I know we talk about that a lot, but really to actually practice your life like that, how freeing your life is when you actually own that strategy. So many good things. I cannot wait to see what you continue to do. Oh gosh, I just love it. I love this concept so much. I would love for you, if you wrap up here, maybe leave us with one last note of encouragement or anything that you'd like to share with those who are listening who might be struggling. And then finally, let people know where they can find you and where they can learn more. We will post everything as well in the show notes to this episode.
Wow, thank you. I guess I want to leave. This is something I felt really strongly sharing. There's this Buddhist parable or story about the two arrows that goes something like, as we said, suffering is universal. The universe is going to throw us arrows and they'll hit us sometimes. And it's going to be painful and it's going to suck. But then it's our role to not allow the second arrow to hit us, which is the mental proliferation, which is that, why me? I wish this was gone. This always happens to me. I'm such a loser. Am I a bad person? Do they hate me? All of that is of our own doing, which is a big blanket statement, but it feels it is a choice. And sometimes we win and sometimes we lose and sometimes the thoughts are too painful. But it's a practice and it's a lifestyle. And sometimes I get messed up and end up reviewing something that happened 5 years ago that I feel guilty about. But at least I know I know I'm choosing to do that. And that is perhaps not the right choice, or the choice that's aligned with the more values-driven life. So what I would love to leave people with is, can we soften around the second arrow and kind of recognize that times where we're making the choice to make our lives more difficult when it doesn't have to be that way, and that we're born on this planet to experience joy and meaning and beauty. So how can we help ourselves to experience that more? People can absolutely find me on my website, naomimatlow.com, and there's an email tab. So please send me an email if this resonates with you, or you'd love to talk about this kind of stuff. And I'm hoping to turn my master's thesis into a book. That's my goal for the next year. That's a bit of a memoir of my OCD journey and how these concepts has helped me or continue to help me daily. And maybe some type of online class or course of mindfulness for OCD inclined minds. So if you send me an email, I can add you to my list when these things go live.
Amazing. I cannot wait to to read this book. This is so amazing. As someone who has I like you said in the beginning, like, I don't call myself a sufferer. I don't suffer with it daily. Like, I probably wouldn't even meet diagnostic criteria for OCD, but it is something that comes up. Like,
yeah,
last night there were intrusive thoughts about my husband was putting my son to bed, and my son, of course, like, he knows what strings to pull now because he's six and he can. And he was like, Mom, I didn't see you at all today. Can you do bedtime? Mm-hmm. And I started to have all these intrusive thoughts of like, oh my gosh, like, am I not spending enough time with him? Like, what if, and core fear, I've talked about this a lot. Mm-hmm. What if I'm like 80 years old and I'm hooked up to a hospital with all these wires coming from me, and I'm just like looking back at my life at all the time that I've lost? This is confirmation that I have lost everything. Yes. He doesn't think I spend enough time with him. And it takes everything in me, and I'm not perfect at it either, but it takes everything in me to be like, I'm not entertaining that. Those are my mm-hmm. thoughts. That thought is not me. Like, it takes energy. It takes
effort. Oh, yeah.
Why everything that it is that you're saying. But what I love about the work that you and I do, Naomi, is that it keeps us honest, right?
Mm-hmm.
I truly believe that one of the reasons why I can like walk the talk so much is because it's my job and this is what I do. So mm-hmm. I hope you, like, just for your sake, that you feel the same and that you just continue to kick so much butt, because the work that you're doing is really amazing and people need it.
Thank you so, so much. Thank you for giving me this platform, because this is the first time I'm like talking about it with a larger audience other than like my small Substack. So this feels really, really special.
Good. It is really special. It was special having you. And thank you guys so much for tuning in. Head to the description of this episode. I'll make sure to list everything where you can find out more about Naomi, get on her email list, on her website, and all the things. So thanks again, Naomi. Thank you guys for tuning in. And until next time, keep doing all the hard things.